Hey y'all, it's Mr. Chaz letting you know that you can still get one-on-one coaching with me through www.patreon.com/Mr. Chaz. And there's been an addition. Since I get hundreds of messages a day on Instagram, there's no way I can reply to them all. But if you subscribe to my Patreon, then I can prioritize your messages and reply back. Now, if you can't subscribe, you know, still shoot your shot. I still may be able to reply. I still often do reply to people who aren't subscribed. But either way, whether you can subscribe or not subscribe, I appreciate you.
What's my name?
Mr.
What's my name?
Mr. Chaz.
What's my name?
Mr. Chaz, Mr. Chaz, Mr. Chaz.
Hey, y'all. This is Mr. Chaz, and today's episode is going to be a little bit different than my typical episodes. You're going to hear me do a lot more talking. I'm going to be talking more about my experience working in this new school. And if you follow me on social media, you know that I've recently taken a job at a school that is struggling. And when I say struggling, I mean they don't have a lot of materials that are present. Leadership is relatively new because the old leadership just quit. And from my understanding, there's been a cycle of a lot of leaders who have quit in the past year or two. And very low staff, which anyone who works in early childhood knows that when you don't have enough teachers, you don't have enough people, that it really impacts the stress of the entire school, the entire environment, what time people are able to get off, or people, or if they're even able to take breaks. So I am in this school and I want to tell you guys about it. Now, there are going to be some conversations later on, too. It's going to be a little bit of a mixed match, but I'm going to just jump right into it. With talking about how I kind of started and how I've entered into something called a closing room. It's been one of my duties. And people on Instagram have been asking me about, you know, what's a closing room? I talked about this kind of big transformation I made in a very short period of time. And people were asking, okay, well, what did you do? And I want to talk more about it here. And more about kind of what was going on, because Instagram, it's just the videos aren't long enough, and I think it's just better for a podcast form. So, starting off, one of my duties was to be in a closing room. Now, what's a closing room? Now, a closing room, typically, you know, you have children in different classrooms throughout the day, because it's just not a good idea to pile a bunch of children into a classroom as much as you can, because there's just a lot wrong with that in terms of being able to meet all the child's needs, having enough materials for all the children in the classroom, meeting environmental standards, lots of things, especially if they're younger, they may need help, the bathrooming and things like that. So anyways, we don't pile a bunch of children throughout the day into a classroom because it's a bad idea. But at some point, those teachers in those different classrooms have to go home. And so what do? We tend to pile a bunch of children into one classroom because people got to go home. And most centers try to delay that as much as possible. But if you don't have a lot of staff, your choice is to either keep your teachers longer so they work longer days, more stress, and they eventually quit and you have, you know, lower staff because they're overworked. Or you kind of just pile everyone at the end of the day and you just kind of figure out how to work with it. So there was a lot of option two going on. And I and another teacher were tasked with kind of just handling, figuring things out. And these rooms aren't very big, but enough where there you can fit 20 children in there. Not exactly enough seating for 20 children, but you can fit them in the room. So what was happening before was that the teachers in whose room we were closing in did not want a lot of things to be out because She was concerned that they would not treat the materials well, which is a legitimate concern. You know, different classrooms have their different cultures and different, you know, rules and ways of being. And when they come in a new room, they got to learn new rules. And it can be kind of difficult to kind of get everyone, all the children and teachers, on the same page. So they were restricting a lot of centers, and there weren't a lot of centers open. What was happening is that we were spending a lot of time telling children what they couldn't do and didn't really have a lot of options to redirect them towards or what they could do. So it was a lot of no, a lot of stop, and that we would frustrate them, and they would act out their frustrations, which would frustrate the teachers. And then they would reciprocate with their frustration. It's just a bad situation to be in, with a negative emotional climate where everyone is frustrated and everyone's in an emotional survival state, and we're just people fighting in a room trying to get to close. In the building I work in, it's open till 6, and it becomes a closing room at 4. So it's 2 hours of telling children that they can only do one or two things in their room. So, you know, a simple solution, just open everything up. But it's not that simple, especially when you're the new guy on the block and you don't necessarily have really great relationships with everyone. So I had to go and connect with the lead teacher in the room, the main teacher in the room, who's it's their room. And as teachers, we can get pretty territorial, you know, over our rooms and the way things are, the way we have things. And this teacher in particular, as I found out when I talked to her, had purchased a lot of materials that were in her room. So she was really concerned about it. You know, she don't have a lot of money, and she's not there to oversee how children are treating it. So she's just, the option was just close it. Now, I was able to talk to her tactfully and understand, validate what she was feeling and validate what her concerns were. And, you know, because I get it. Like, this is not a new concern. I've been in the field for a long time, and this has always kind of been a conversation about the closing room, and no one likes the room to be a closing room. So I talked to her, I validated those feelings, and kind of asked, like, you know, we have a lot of kids in here, like, we're at capacity for the room. And she actually, as I kind of validated her feelings and her concerns, she actually came back, was like, there is not enough room in here for 20 kids. You know, there's not enough materials in here for 20 kids. And I said, I know, right? There isn't. And so we were able to kind of connect with that. And I was able to say that, you know, that's why I want to open up more centers. I want to open up, you know, the dramatic play, and I want to open up some sensory. And at the end of the conversation, she agreed, but, you know, with the condition. I said, you know, I'll take a picture of the centers and we'll make sure to have it back the way so it's ready for the morning for you. And, you know, we'll definitely reset the room and do everything we can to reset the room. And if we miss something, because, like, I don't know exactly what your room is look like and where everything is supposed to be the way it's supposed to be, I'm still learning, you know, let me know. Like, I'll check in with you and let me know so that I can just get better at it, and I can improve my ability to set the room the way that you like it in the morning. So we're all meeting our needs. She agreed, and we collaborated, and she agreed to open up the centers. But for me, that wasn't, you know, quite enough. It was good that she was able to open up the centers, but I also recognized in the time that I was in there, as I was observing, that there are a lot of children who are very, they just need sensory stimulation, and they weren't getting it, and it wasn't available to them. And instead, what they were doing is that they were trying to meet their sensory needs through each other, you know, pushing and grabbing each other, and then eventually the teachers, and really my co-teacher. So I had also talked to my director about trying to bring in more materials. And at this point, my director so new, she doesn't even have a credit card to go out and buy things. So we didn't even have a budget. So I talked to her and I collaborated with the director. She said she had some Play-Doh at home. And so she brought some Play-Doh, which was great. And she brought another big bin we went in the center and we found some like drawers. They're like little plastic drawers. We turned them into trays and we made like individual sensory trays with some sand, with some Play-Doh. And I also used a bin to make a water table. It's not exactly a water table, but we improvised. A legit water table would be deeper, and that helps children not getting the water out on the floor. But, you know, we did what we could do. We worked with what we had. And so that's what I added to the room. I talked to the children about, you know, what the expectations were. You know, one of the big things is keep the sensory inside the bin. Keep the Play-Doh inside the tray. Keep the water inside the water table. Keep the sand inside the tray. And just to make it more manageable for us to keep and care for our materials, but also to kind of clean up at the end of the day while we're doing all the other closing duties. And then another thing that I did that I haven't been doing as explicitly, more implicitly at this point, as I'm still building more relationships and understanding teachers and seeing them, and so I can be in a better position to be helpful and maybe potentially, you know, guide them more directly. Is I've really started modeling different ways to problem solve and handle situations, really using the skill of empathy, really using the skill of choices. And I've honestly seen a difference, not even just in this closing room, but a difference in other rooms I've worked in with other teachers, of how that has impacted their approach, how they're more likely to move to choices, more likely to move to empathy and to practice those skills, which has been a big help in minimizing the survival state that children tend to go into when we react and we scold and we shame and we yell and we react aggressively. So those are like the real big things that we've been working on. And it's not perfect, right? You know, I always say perfect doesn't exist. You know, children still have conflict. You know, we still, you know, talk about taking turns and talking to each other and advocating, you know, asking for a turn when you want something the next, not just taking it. When someone does take things, how do you, you know, get your toy back? And sometimes they need a little bit of support in that. Practicing, you know, different ways, and really on the teachers to encourage children to clean up in a way where we're not shaming them and yelling at them. So these are things that I've really been implementing that I've seen a really big difference. And I've been checking in with the kind of main co-teacher I've been in there. And since we've been implementing the changes, I'll check in with her at the end of the day and like, how are you feeling about today? And every day it's been better and better and better and better and feel, and she notices the dramatic change. Now, I don't expect this to be, my alarm recording this. I gotta get started with my day. I got a session pretty soon. And then I got, going to the school. But anyways, we don't expect, just like in any learning, that it's going to continuously just be better and better and better forever, right? There's going to be some times, there's going to be some days where we struggle more than other days, where we lose our stuff, we're a little bit more exhausted, we're a little bit more frustrated, we're a little bit more, maybe something is going on in our personal lives and we just don't have the emotional resources to keep it together. And that's going to happen. And those are opportunities for learning and getting better, knowing what to do when we get in those situations, and even opportunities for empathy of when children aren't able to keep it together and they struggle and they have harder days. But now, as I'm checking in with her, she's feeling better about the way things are going. I'm checking in with the main teacher. She's saying that things are at least good enough. The room is good enough. She hasn't had really too many complaints. There's been some things where it's like, okay, well, this, you know, the floor is still a little bit sandy. So we're like, okay, we need to make sure that we do maybe a better job of sweeping at the end of the day, and really trying to just kind of reinforce the expectations of all the sensory that we are adding, because we're going to add more, and you know, at some point they're going to get bored of it. I'm going to add more things to it that are going to be maybe even more messy, but we're at the very ground level of kind of like easy things to clean up and easy things to play with. And hopefully we also get better materials as times go on too. You know, someone actually asked me about a wish list, and I thought about it, and I kind of want to thought about like, okay, I could probably post online and probably get a bunch of things from people who are willing to support. But you know what? I really want to take this opportunity. Like, I don't want to just use, because I have this platform and I have a little bit more resources than what the average teacher would be, which you guys, the audience, and I appreciate y'all and I love y'all. I don't want to overuse that or over kind of exercise that, because I really want to go through this experience as a typical teacher, not a teacher who has, you know, over 500,000 followers across platforms. Because not everyone's going to do that. I want to figure out how to work things, how to advocate for things and get better at advocating for things on a school level, on a corporate level, and get better at acquiring things the way typical teachers would. While so many typical teachers can use social media, I want to use other skills, and then be able to report back to you and tell you, you know, this is how, with the very little resources, that we did what we did, how we kind of navigated that, how we problem solved, how we worked with parents, how I worked with the directors, how I worked with corporate, and how we were able to be successful and really transform the school with starting with nothing, not even a credit card for the school. So that is how I transformed this kind of closing room. There's still more work to be done. Again, I don't expect it to be perfect. I expect there to be more hiccups, more bumps in the road. Still learning the kids, still learning the teachers. But that's where I'm at right now. So I hope this was helpful. And you know, whether you are a parent who is looking at a school and maybe have more insight into, like, you know, centers or you work at a school, or even, you know, you have children and thinking about maybe this inspires or sparks ideas for moments where you want, you know, to encourage independent play, or when they're doing independent play, how you can kind of navigate situations in a way that everyone can be successful. And how you can kind of communicate with some of the adults, because I think one of the biggest, what took the most time really was communicating and working with the adults in all the moving parts, the lead teacher, whose room that is, who is quite understandably territorial about their space. The co-teacher who is I'm working with in the evening, who is still learning, growing right with the rest of us. The director, who is kind of our boss, who's in charge of everything and communicating and figuring out what we can do and how we can work together, and how I can kind of garner support, starting with nothing. So that's where I'm at. Now enjoy the rest of the episode as I talk to someone who I worked with in the previous company I worked with, who, you know, I think in this episode she doesn't even do herself justice with the introduction. This is a person who's really in the early childhood field, and she has been the president of some associations at a state level. She has worked with some accreditations. She has just been an also really awesome mentor to me as well. As I was first learning and didn't know all this stuff and was not in a position to transform anything, I was just trying to transform myself. Hope you enjoy the rest of the episode and you got a little something out of this. Please leave a review and let me know if you like these little precursors and like these little updates. And if not, you don't, yeah, send me a message, let me know, give me feedback. And also, you know, next time you can kind of just skip if this is not of interest to you. But it's going to change, and I'm gonna take in your feedback and really address some things in more depth than I have on this podcast by myself. Normally I have people who bring on really the thought process behind the podcast, just bring on resources. And I think even all of the podcast episodes before, you have plenty and plenty, plenty of resources to pull from, to learn from, that's outside of me. So you can kind of build your own community, your own village of people who are helping you learn and grow and support on your journey, whether you're a parent, a teacher, or a leader.
This meeting is being recorded.
Welcome to Mr. Chaz's Leadership, Parenting, and Teaching podcast, where I introduce you to the people that can help you on your parenting, teaching, or leadership journey. And today, y'all, I know I say this often that I have a special episode, but this one is really going to be special to my heart because I'm introducing you to someone who I've known for a very long time. As a personal mentor, a friend, it's someone you really need to know. And I've imagined her being on this podcast since the start of the podcast. And now all the stars have aligned in both of our careers where this is, I believe, the perfect time to have this conversation. So without any further ado, I am going to let Dr. Myra Sawyers introduce herself. And just, you know, Myra, tell us a little bit about you and just tell us a little bit about you.
Wow. I too am thrilled to finally be here and share this moment with you. Thankful that the stars have finally aligned. And we are both at this, you know, wonderful place in, and we get to share this time together. I feel like I wear so many different hats. I'm a mom. I've been married for 23 years. Whoops, had to think about that. I have been a community activist. Advocate. I have run for public office. I have worked on Capitol Hill as a legislative aide. But I think, you know, where our paths have crossed as educators is where my heart has been and what has guided so much of my work, and especially in early childhood education. I think where we, in our previous positions, the work that we did was always focused on how do we best serve children and families, and what learning environments, what sort of supports are necessary, essential to giving them, providing them with the foundation they need to be successful in life. And I know you've heard me say many, many times, but you know, everything that happens in early child education, you know, is significant and will significantly impact a child, a person later on in life. And so much of my work is guided by this. It is my passion. In many ways, I feel my calling because I just am constantly thinking about how my work is, you know, when I do my work well and do it the best that I can, the direct beneficiaries are children and families. So when I'm in a school, when I'm, you know, supporting teachers in a classroom, or principals or directors, or if I'm doing a professional development, or if I'm doing a training, if I'm doing a presentation, if I'm doing research, if I'm, you know, writing an article, it's always, you know, with the thought in mind, you know, how is this going to support children and families? And And so, you know, in my current position, I'm so fortunate that I get to continue doing that. And so
what is your current position?
Currently, I am the state director for a global nonprofit that focuses on education improvement. So we support schools in building their continuous improvement cultures. I know that sounds kind of like, you know, what is that? But it really, you know, is, you know, looking at schools where they're at and, you know, helping them identify where they want to be and developing the steps for getting there. And really embracing continuous improvement, because continuous improvement is not finite. It is, there is no end game. And if anything, you know, you're only focused on, you know, how do we better serve children and families? And, but what does that mean? What does that look like? And it doesn't look the same for every school. Because everyone comes into the continuous improvement process at different places. And so there's no one perfect place. Okay. You can, you know, start the continuous improvement process when you're here. We're all there. And if you, but it's gotta be something intentional, and it's gotta be something, you know, that you commit to, because it's not easy. It's hard.
Yeah. I think
got me started. You know, it always happens when we get together.
Yeah. You know, like talking about continuous improvement, it should not be something that is foreign. Like that is a very common theme in, you know, the content that I put out and the social media and podcasts. Anyone who's followed me for a bit of time know that I always say, you know, avoid trying to be a perfectionist, be an improvinist. The goal isn't to be perfect every day. The goal is to improve a little every day. And, you know, a lot of what I bring onto social media and some of the like reoccurring things, like you could hear that in what you're talking about and your continuous improvement and meeting people where they're at and supporting them, no matter, you know, where they're at, that the journey is continuous. There is no destination. And so I just want the people out there to, I'm going to, before you go deeper into talking about what you do, and today I really want to talk more about STEM, because it's been in the past somewhat of a buzzword, but I know working with you that there is so much more to it than what people typically think about. And we're going to dive into that today, the power and importance of it and how to go about it. Because a lot of people aren't aware. They just think it's like, oh, like robotics, like it's STEM is that thing where we give the kids technology and they learn how to use robots and iPads and, you know, that those kind of traditional, those higher technologies, as you talk about. But before we even get into that, I want to share a story about how I know you. But before I even get into that, I want to hear, like, from your perspective, and audience, this is a different kind of podcast. I tell you, this is a special episode. I want to hear from your perspective, how do you know me? Like, what is our connection together? Like, just, I don't know. I want to hear just from your perspective.
Well, I mean, our formal connection, right, our professional connection was, you know, I was part of the education team of, you know, in our previous position, we were part of the same education team. And so we went to schools and we, you know, we supported teachers mostly in the classroom, you know, whether it was, you know, modeling or, you know, providing them with, you know, that you got this, you're doing great, you know, and you know, provide feedback, you know, all of that. And then doing professional developments and trainings together. But I think what really brought us together was our interest in the conversations, the higher mm-hmm. level conversations. And mm-hmm. we spent hours talking about, you know, not just the work, but the meaning of the work and the impact of the work. And I so valued that because, you know, we were in early child education before COVID and we knew what the challenges were then. But at the same time, we're so grateful to be in the field because we knew, I mean, just knowing the research, knowing the data, knowing the science, how important early childhood education is to human development, birth, you know, to five, mm-hmm. Really birth to eight. And those early years really, really matter. And so being a part of that was really, was powerful. And transferring that to the teachers, to the directors every day in the most authentic way, because we knew how hard the work was, but we knew how important it was, you know, and just having those conversations, you know, that really elevated the meaning and made it, you know, more than daycare, you know, more than what unfortunately so many people see it as, you know, babysitting, all those terms that we kind of, you know, cringe at when we hear them, but knowing that and connecting to that.
That's when you, and I think that's when our friendship really started to blossom. And I remember even like, you know, driving, and I always commuted, always had sometimes, you know, 30 minute to up to a 2 hour commute, depending on where I was going, and, you know, having conversations in the car, you know, with you, and, you know, trying to have a lunch so that we can, you know, talk about these ideas. And, you know, I just remember that being something to recharge me in the hustle and bustle of things and to give more. I really did feel like those were conversations where it was almost, it was a way for me to recharge, for me to give more to the, you know, teachers and all and directors and all the people that we supported. But that's not where I would say that our relationship started. And this probably isn't as big of a memory for you as it is for me. And I've told you about this, you know, once or twice before, but I remember when I first started working in the company that we worked for, and I knew nothing at the time. And I've told stories before of how, like, when I first started working, I was kind of felt kind of thrown in there and struggling. And there were some things that I was good at, but I was totally not equipped to handle the challenges that were that of all the children in the classroom of, you know, the mixed age group of 3 to 5. I was not prepared for that. But I had a leader who really believed in me. And so she would send me to trainings. And I remember the first training that I went to, and it was already before I went there. I remember there was a friend that I had kind of like gotten a job with, and we were like talking, we're like, man, this is crazy. We'd have conversations about how, like, what are you supposed to do? Like, this is bananas. Like, how did we not know how crazy this was going to be? And so you'd have those conversations, somewhat venting, somewhat just like, wow, this is crazy. And then we both walked into that training that you did, and the training was positive guidance. And I think that was definitely, thank goodness it was like, it was that training as opposed to maybe like health and safety, which might not have been inspiring, really important, but maybe not as inspiring. And I think on that day, I needed to be inspired. I needed to start that conversation that we continued on years later, you know, when, you know, we were supporting teachers, you know, when I was in a different capacity after I had learned a lot more and grew a lot more, definitely still had a lot more to learn. But that conversation for me started with that training. And, you know, just to say, like, and that really put me on a trajectory. And I'm not going to say that you weren't the only person who I learned from or felt mentored by, but I definitely attribute that experience, that kind of first training, as really putting me on a trajectory to learning more and and expanding my perspective on things. And I just want to say in front of the world, thank you for that. And I also, I'm also talking about this in front of everyone because just to highlight the importance of our own like learning and growth and being with other people who are having these conversations and who are elevating the conversation, who have, you know, maybe a different perspective or a different way of seeing things than you do to really, if you have those opportunities now, I see, and sometimes I'm a part of those like conferences that are free to people. Now we do things, a lot of things virtually, right? And so you might feel some hesitation to go to it, or you might feel like, you know, you're not going to get something out of it, or, you know, maybe you don't have time to do it. I really, really, really encourage you to try to, especially if this is something new to you, if you're learning to parent or teach in a different way, or you're like me and you're in a classroom and you're like, there's gotta be a better way than just yelling at the kids until we scare them into compliance. There's gotta be a better way. And, you know, if you're like me and you're searching, really try to invest, take time, make time. You know, I don't know what your situation is. I don't know who you can lean on to support you, or what you can ask of your director, if you're a teacher. But definitely, definitely go and search for that information and find teachers that really inspire you. Because the other thing about it was that there are other people who might share the same information that you share. But I think it's different for everyone that like there might be certain teachers that really connect with and really inspire you. So really go out and search for those people, find those people, you know, build your community, find your tribe, and let that, you know, take shelter in that as you are stepping out of your comfort zone and learning and trying and just know, you know, have that tribe, that community, those teachers that you can go back to and take safety and shelter with, because that's who you were for a long period of time. And while I didn't always see you, and even in the beginning, I didn't have your number, whenever I would go to those trainings, you were there, like, I would be excited and like, ooh, I got some questions to ask, right? I got some time that I'm going to try to steal from you. I know it's 9 o'clock at night, but I have some questions to ask. So I just wanted to share that, you know, it's not as often where I share a lot of personal experiences about my growth. You will hear me share more and more, but mostly this podcast has been about just giving you, you know, like practical tools and tip and information perspectives that help you. But I also recognize it's important to, you know, I know you, a lot of people ask about my journey. So I wanted to share that. Now, go ahead.
Wanted to thank you for, you know, that, because so much of my trainings and my professional developments were developed, because, you know, planning a training and then planning a professional development was a lot of work, right? Because you realize you would have, 15, 20, 30, sometimes 40 people in a room, and, you know, and it would be for 3 hours or 6 hours or, you know, multiple days in a row. And so, you know, yes, they were there to get content and information, but, you know, when I was trying to put, you know, these trainings and professional developments together, I always wanted to also think of how I was going to inspire them. And to hear that you got that is wonderful, because, you know, some days were better than others.
Yeah,
right? For sure. And then, you know, going back to why I so appreciated our conversations is because we needed to build each other up, because we were investing so much into our teachers because we knew how important it was for them to be inspired, to be ready in the classroom because, you know, they were with the children and they were those teacher-child interactions. We know how important they are. And if, you know, they're not being inspired, if they're not, you know, present and ready in the classroom, then, you know, the children know that, children feel that. And so, you know, every time, you know, they came to, I had my moment with them. I wanted to make sure I was giving back so that they could, you know, give back to the children. So thank you for, you know, being ready to receive that, because I also know that a lot of teachers came to those trainings and professional developments feeling drained and just, you know, I don't know if I can make it. So cross my fingers, right? Because we know, you know, what kind of investment it is. And I'm always so grateful that you were part of that.
Yeah. And two, you know, just, I know that, so I mentioned I went to that training with a friend, and, you know, she was inspired too, but there was, I guess what I want to say in this moment is that there takes, I think, in this profession, you really have to be clear and on what your why is and why you're doing and why you're here, and committed to it. And when we sometimes, you know, a lot of times there are a lot of people who come into the profession very young, and it's understandable that you don't know your why, or, you know, you're really just still figuring yourself out, let alone trying to figure out what you want to, what you're passionate about, which, by the way, I think we could do a lot better with children and talking to them about and supporting them in earlier on. But, you know, I just want to say that, you know, there are a lot of pieces, and being clear on why you're doing what you're doing is a really important piece. But I wanted to actually transition the conversation a little bit to more of the content part of the podcast. And this was, I want to talk about STEM, as I alluded to earlier. And you and another person developed this program that I got to see, you know, I went to trainings for, I got to see, you know, people, you know, implement it. A part of implementation a lot of times. I was able to see, you know, children grow into the program where, you know, they were, you know, see them as young as 3, 4, and then go into the kindergarten program and just see how that program and those ideas impacted children. And one thing, before we even get into the details of it, I'm just going to share one of the big things that stuck out to me in the change that I would see in children, or how children would grow and develop in this program, that when children made a mistake, when they were working on something, they were trying something and they made a mistake, you would hear often, and not just in one kindergarten STEM program. I saw this attitude and approach in multiple kindergarten STEM programs, but you would see them and hear them talk about, oh, like, it's a, like, we can try again. Why don't you try it a different way? Or some things like, oh, it's okay, it didn't work. How could we improve it? What else can we do? These were things that I heard children, you know, saying and responding to themselves, talking to themselves and talking to each other, right? It's one thing when you hear that you walk in the classroom, your teacher saying the things and like, oh, wow, like, great. Like, they did the training. They know the thing. Not only do they know the information, they're implementing it. Awesome. But to hear how they, like, you know, been able to create that culture when it's been able to kind of permeate into the nervous system of children and the way that they, you know, respond to challenges. That was, I gotta say, probably there are a lot of special things and, like, really cool, visually pleasing things about the program. But that to me was the most powerful part of the program and the most powerful lesson, most valuable thing to me personally. Other people may have valued other things, but to me personally, and I think it goes along with kind of that continuous improvement and just, you know, me knowing how important it is to just have that approach, that growth mindset of improving and it not having the fixed mindset. So before you go deep into it, I want you to tell me about the engineering design process, because I believe that that was a huge part of where that approach and that attitude came, like why children were able to, you know, fail, mess up, and still be able to have the attitude instead of just being down on themselves, like, oh, I'm so stupid, I couldn't do it, oh, I'll never get it right. They would be more likely to go straight into improving, how can we make it better? Can you tell me a little bit about the engineering design process? And then, you know, yeah, talk about the program and more.
Of course, absolutely. You know, it's one of my favorite things to talk about.
Right? That's why I had you on.
Because, you know, back in the day when we first developed it, my colleague, Dr. Rosemary Burton, you know, we were bringing STEM to early learning. And in those days, you know, this was like, you know, 2008, 2009, you know, no one was thinking of STEM in the early learning classroom. You know, STEM was synonymous. You mentioned robotics and, you know, what I affectionately refer to as the bling STEM, where it was, you know, how do you bring more high technology into the classroom? And, you know, working with young children, we just knew that, well, this is the most, you know, children are born engineers. Right. There's a wonderful book written by Henry Petrovsky that, you know, to engineer is human. Children naturally want to recreate their world. They're curious about materials. They want to touch and feel things and build things. And so knowing this as early childhood educators, we were kind of like, well, this is for us where it makes the most sense. So we created the STEM early learning program and intentionally emphasized the E in STEM, engineering, because we knew that if we just gave children opportunities to build things and solve problems, you know, all the other, the science, the technology, the math would come together, right? And so we use children's stories to introduce, because we started this program, you know, back in 2009, actually, was when we had our first kindergarten STEM program. And there was no curriculum. And we sort of had to create it, you know, as we went along. And you know, we, of course, if you're an early child educator, you love stories. And you know, children love stories. So we immediately gravitated to stories and started there. And who knew, you know, that the classics we all grew up with, the Three Little Pigs, the, you know, Three Billy Goats Gruff, you know, they were all STEM books that, you know, the Three Little Pigs was a book on materials engineering. The Three Billy Goats Gruff was a, you know, story on civil engineering. And you know, Rapunzel will turn it into a story that we could teach simple machines. So anyways, it started there. And so we, in teaching engineering, you know, you start with the engineering design the engineering design process, and built into it, it, because engineers solve problems, and the expectation is, you know what, it doesn't always work. And so you got to fix it. You got to make it better. You don't just say, oh, well, we tried, move on, right? It doesn't work that way. If you're, you know, constructing a building, or if you're building a bridge, or if you're, you know, building anything to solve a problem, the goal is to solve the problem.
Yeah.
And it's not always an easy process. So the engineering design process, you know, is a process, and we taught it to young children, but in a way that was developmentally appropriate to them, and it made sense, and something we started at the beginning of the year and continued throughout the year. Anytime there was an engineering project, anytime we used a story to introduce us an engineering problem, we went back to the engineering design process and reviewed it with children. So by the end of the year, you know, all of them, you know, knew the process and it was meaningful to them. So it starts with an idea, right? You're given a problem. You need to build a bridge. You need to build, you know, a machine. You need to build, you know, something, a structure to solve a problem. You kind of have to think about, okay, what am I going to build? What is the thing that is going to solve the problem? And then you design it, you know, you have to write it out. You have to, you know, what is it going to look like? Right. And then you plan it, you know, what materials are you going to use? And are you going to be able to use these materials in a way that's going to build, or, you know, in order, is this going to construct the thing you want to construct? And this is where the introduction to materials was really important. We had, you know, you saw our classrooms, it was just filled with different materials. And there's, you know, focus on studying, you know, those different materials. What's the difference between a plastic material and, you know, a material made of wood or made out of metal or, you know, so because you have to think about that when you plan something, what materials are you going to use? And then you build it. So this is the part where, you know, you see the frustration because you build it and then you test it and it doesn't always work. So this is the part where you have to stop and think and, you know, all right, how am I going to improve it? How am I going to make it better? And that's not always easy for children, but because this is something that's woven into the program, you know, it's not taught only when you do engineering projects, but it's continuously taught in the program. The expectation is you're going to improve it and then you're going to test it again. Yeah. And they're going to improve it. And it's that's the continuous improvement process.
So, okay, right, lay out the engineering design process for us again.
So it's an idea.
Idea.
The design, right? You draw it out, what's going to look like, the plan, what materials are you going to use? You build it, right? Okay. And then test it because does it work? And then you improve it.
Okay. So that almost sounds to me like not only the process of building, you know, building a structure, engineering something, it also sounds like engineering some kind of collaborative problem solving, right? Like the first thing that we have to do is identify what the problem is, right? So what's the problem? Then we have to decide, plan on like, okay, so how are we going to solve the problem? Like, what are the things that, like, what's your problem? What's my problem? What are our concerns? And we kind of like plan it out. You have that conversation. Then you build it. You try to do the thing. Okay, so we see our concerns. This is the way that we're going to try to solve the problem, right? This is the way that we're going to, you know, talk to each other when we want a, you know, when we want a toy. This is the way that we're going to, you know, try to get out the door on time. This is the way that we are going to use materials in the classroom, whatever it is, you know, we plan and then we build out that plan, right? We talk about what does that actually look like? And then we try it out, right? We test it out because not every solution that we come up with is going to be necessarily sturdy, or maybe we didn't understand the problem as well as we thought that we did. We go into problem solving, not problem solving with things just in our environment, but problem solving with things with each other with that in mind, that we're going to try some things and it may not work out perfectly. We tried our best, but realistic life happens, right? Sometimes things mess up. Sometimes we don't have all the information, but we'll find that out when we test it. And then we'll go back to the drawing board. If it's not a sturdy solution, if it's not something that is going to actually work practically. And then we try again, we go through it again. So like, you know, it's just really powerful that not only like it's just going through that problem solving process of, you know, we're going to identify the problem. We're going to try to solve it. And if it doesn't work, we're going to try again, as opposed to, you know, we try the solution and we tried everything. And so like, I'm just going to throw my hands up and give up, or, you know, there's no way that this relationship can ever work. It is a problem solving is a process, not necessarily just a one-time solution. But I think that's why I think the engineer design process and the program was just so powerful for me to just be around and experience and to see and to be a part of.
It really was and is, because, you know, you so eloquently, of course, attach it to other things, right? It's not just an engineering problem. It is life. And we get kind of caught up in, you know, solutions, right? We need a solution for this because it makes us feel effective. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there is a process to problem solving.
Yeah.
And finding a solution. And, you know, there's a wonderful word that I'd like to use it because it just sounds so silly. And, you know, being early child educators, we like silly words, but it's called solutionitis. It's this, you know, we find, you know, it's kind of like the check the box. We've got a solution, check, move on, but it may not be the right solution. And we may not have done enough to design, plan, and build and test a solution.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I think some of us, there's this struggle with, you know, we've got to feel like we're being effective. And this is, you know, a lot of leaders struggle with that, right? Yeah. I need to prove myself, and I need to prove that I can solve problems and I can find solutions without really committing to the process first.
Yeah.
And that process, the process is always the most important part, because at the end of the day, you'll have a shiny, you know, skyscraper or a brand new bridge, and, you know, but it's a structure that solves a problem. It gets people from one place to another, or people can live or work in this structure. And, but it needs a strong foundation. It needs materials that are going to work. And, you know, the process, it cannot exist without the process. Mm. And so part of the engineering design process, you know, yes, it was, you know, in our STEM program, and yes, it was linked to engineering, but it was also our social emotional component.
Yeah.
Right. This was, you know, connecting children to their environment and making it meaningful and purposeful, but also teaching them how to live and manage and be in the world. And I have to say, there was always a story for everything, right, in our program. And there is a wonderful book that teaches children the engineering design process. And can I say it?
Yeah.
Yeah. The Most Magnificent Thing by Ashley Spires. And it is a story of, you know, a little girl wanting to build the most magnificent thing. And she goes through the entire engineering design process, and she even gets upset. And she, you know, there's these wonderful illustrations of her face turning red, and, you know, she's just ready to explode. But then she calms herself down. She goes for a walk, and then she comes back.
Mm-hmm.
And then she builds the most magnificent thing, to her, of course, because it's all relative, right?
Yeah, that is, thank you for sharing that. And I thank you for sharing that, because I think, you know, people, a lot of times, you know, they hear all this stuff, okay, but what can I go out and actively do? People probably went right to Amazon and like ordered that, like, oh, like, how do I apply this? What can I do? And why this is such a powerful way to teach these skills, is because children already gravitate to these. They already gravitate to stories and build it. You know, they gravitate to it so much. It's a cliche at this point when we talk about, you know, the whole thing of we buy them the toys for Christmas and they just play with the box, right? And like, mm-hmm. you buy them all these toys, but they're just playing, picking up sticks and rocks and playing, you know, having long little play periods just with those simple materials, right? Because they're exploring them, they're manipulating, they're seeing how the stick, can the stick fit in? If there's a hole in the box, if we put the stick in there, will it stand up? If I put something else on it, will it fall over? Is the stick sturdy enough? You know, they're learning so much through those processes. And it's a way where I think a lot of times we want to have these like conversations with children and talk to them sometimes on a very like high level about like these big adults' concerns and ideas that aren't meaningful to them. They're very meaningful to us, but maybe not as meaningful to them in this time in their life. Maybe resilience isn't a word that exactly resonates with, you know, that, you know, 4-year-old or 5-year-old or 6-year-old or 7-year-old, right? And so using the engineering design process and using kind of just giving them materials and it's really not I found that it wasn't, you know, once you kind of figured out the general approach of how to think about it, and how to ask questions, once like that, I found was probably the hardest part for people, the actual implementation of it, of like the materials aren't expensive, right? I think a lot of times people would get, you know, cardboard boxes, sticks, rocks, sand, aluminum foil. Like these are things that I've just named like 5 or 6 materials and you don't have to go out and buy any of them. Those are things that you can find in your environment. And I think it's really
that was one of the things that really resonate whenever I present, because I am the first person. One of the first things I say is STEM program is not expensive. It should not be expensive.
And everyone's like, what? I spent $2,000 on my smart board. Like video,
right?
XYZ.
You know, what about those flat screens? What about, you know, all of those iPads? It's like, yeah, put them away. And wish we had talked first. Because if you really think, well, because you have to think what the outcome is, right? The outcome is that inventive, you know, innovative thinking, that problem solving. And, you know, if we're thinking about, you know, you hear this all the time. You know, if we're thinking about the next generation of learners, right? Or, you know, what's the future? You know, what are we preparing our students for, right? What's the future going to look like? What jobs, right, are they going to have? And people are, you know, we don't know. You hear this all the time. You know, the technology is changing so quickly. We, you know, what's the next iPhone? What's the next, you know, car or you know, space travel vehicle.
Yeah.
We
or
don't
Google
know.
Glasses or so, virtual reality, right? Or augmented reality. Yeah.
So we should be creating, we should be, you know, creating, you know, learning environments that challenge children to think what's next, to build that next technology, because they may be, you know, inheriting a world where, you know, they're not going to, where they're going to have to create the technology that's going to build the next workforce and or support the next workforce. And so, you know, it's worth considering, you know, what are the skills that we're giving our children today, and how do we what are the learning environments that support that? And so, So yeah, STEM is not expensive. It's and it's more than, you know, because you think science, technology, engineering, and math, and you think of this acronym in isolation. You think of just science, you think of technology, you think of engineering, you think of math, and you think of these subjects in isolation. And really, STEM has become, it's definitely, you know, STEM early learning has become a way of teaching that incorporates all of these subjects in focuses on engineering, but you know, you learn science through engineering. You learn about technology and technology, you know, not just high technology, but technology that's really about solving problems and what new technology are you going to create to solve a problem. And then, you know, engineering and then math, right? And you know, we traditionally have school systems where these subjects are taught in isolation. And really, that's not how the world exists. You know, these subjects exist in our lives simultaneously at the same time. And so therefore we should, and it definitely does in an early learning classroom, yeah. You know, we talk about active learning all the time and children are constantly touching, feeling and exploring, and they're experiencing these science, technology, engineering and math concepts. Yeah. You know, that's where the rigor comes in, quote unquote. You know, people are like, these, you know, children aren't ready for this, quote, rigor. Well, they are, but children are absolutely ready for concepts. If it's done in a developmentally appropriate environment where children are, you know, engaging in a world that's meaningful to them, you know, children are ready to learn algebra. They are ready to learn physics. I mean, they're experiencing physics every day when yeah. they, you know, roll a ball or kick a ball or throw a ball or something.
Or when the two-year-old goes and knocks down all the blocks.
Yeah. And then it's like, and you see the look on their face because it's sort of like there's an excitement, there's sound, there's, you know, movement. And instead of getting upset about it, you know, and enjoy the moment because they have been introduced to several, you know, STEM concepts.
Yeah.
And so
can I ask
yeah.
you, I want to know about that the bridge building project, right? And how you, because we're talking right now about like, okay, you can incorporate science, technology, engineering, and math all together. How did that, and I know bridge build, can you tell us a little bit about the bridge building project and kind of how that incorporated science, technology, engineering, and math?
Around the bridge building?
Yes.
So, first, you know, you introduce the story, right? Yeah. So we would use the Three Billy Goats Gruff, or, you know, a story where there's, you know, a bridge prominent in the story. And then, you know, we would talk about the bridge, talk about the length of the bridge, talk about the height of the bridge, talk about what the bridge looks like, why the bridge was, you know, designed a certain way, because, you know, you also incorporate the art, right? The aesthetics of a bridge. And so we would, you know, talk about different bridges around the world. So you'd introduce geography, you introduce history. And then you, again, incorporating the engineering design process, you have them design it, you have them plan it, you have them build it, and then you test it. So there's weight involved, right? So if we're gonna, what's gonna be involved in the weight test? Are we gonna use books? Are we gonna use blocks? Are we gonna use cars? Are we gonna use, you know, other vehicles? So, I mean, all of these conversations, you know, you're having during the entire process, and they don't happen all at the same time, because, you know, a lot of these projects take several days to build, because, you know, you're designing, you're planning, you're building, and then you have to let it dry, and then you have to test yeah. it, then you have yeah. to paint it, then yeah. you have to, you know, and write a story about it. Of course, there's always literacy involved, there's language. I mean, but these things are happening, you know, so organically that you it's a very natural process. But when you start to, you know, separate and you start to break it down, you start touching upon all of these others. You realize you're touching upon all these other subject areas. And, but it's done in a very natural way in which children, you know, we learn and experience the world. We're constantly making observations, but it's that intentionality. It's that awareness that this is happening. This learning is happening. And, you know, going back to, you know, active learning is a way of learning that, you know, children are from birth are engaged in, but it's, you know, that educator that is aware of it and is intentional and creates those environments that allows for, you know, that learning to happen. And it's not just, you know, they're not just winging it, right? You don't just put a ball in front of an infant and think, oh, you know, we got balls in the classroom. Let's, you know, just put them on the floor and see what happens. But knowing that when you're putting, you know, a soft, squishy, round object in front of an infant, you're intentionally putting it there so that they can reach, grab, and squeeze that object. And that physical development is very important to their long-term development, because one day without thinking, right, they're going to reach, grab, and squeeze a writing tool, and that begins the writing process, right? And that's huge. But if they don't have those opportunities and you don't have an educator those early years, you know, intentionally, you know, making sure that children are, you know, reaching, grabbing, and squeezing, crawling, reaching, grabbing, and squeezing, climbing, reaching, grabbing, and squeezing, you know, that's going to significantly impact them negatively, because then they're one day not going to be able to reach, grab, and squeeze that writing tool. And we all know about the tripod grip and the importance of that tripod grip to, you know, begin those stages of writing, the scribbling, and then the more controlled writing, the shapes, and then those shapes become letters, and those letters become words, and those words become sentences. And, you know, before you know it, they're winning a Pulitzer Prize winning novel, or, you know, they're designing the next supercar or the next, you know, space shuttle. But, you know, again, you know, making those connections, and gosh, you and I have talked about this so much, why those early years are so important, that it is the beginning years of human development. Yeah. And so going back to STEM, you know, the STEM early learning program was a really important part of that, because it was something we could bring into the infant classroom, the toddler classroom, and it, you know, each year built on the other. And then we were able to, you know, start the engineering design process and in the kindergarten classroom. And it was just really wonderful to see children just enjoy it, because we were creating a learning experience that started where they were developmentally. Yeah. You know, yes. Children are born engineers. To engineer is human.
Yes. Children, if you're going to remember any quote from this, just remembering that children are natural born engineers, and just take that quote and then just watch them for a little while. And you're going to, you might see the little things that they do when they're playing with stuff or messing with stuff in a completely different light. You might start seeing it as they're exploring, they're testing, they're designing, they're improving, they're building.
I change your shopping habits.
It might. I want to take a wider view. Now I want to back up. We talked about us and how we know each other. We talked about STEM and early learning. Now I want to talk about childcare in general. And I want to talk to you about it, because you have, like you said, you've kind of worked in policy, and you've definitely been kind of on the political side of things, but also you've been on in the classroom side of things, and the kind of like the professional development trainer side of things. And you know, you've seen it from a lot of perspectives, and you've been in a lot of roles to actually to make some, you know, make some impact. And so I want to know from you, or just what your thoughts are about, you know, what is kind of the state of childcare as you see it, and kind of what are the things that we could improve in childcare, things that need to be improved. I know that's a very big question with a lot of systems involved, with a lot of I know, but I'm going to ask you and just see what you come up with. What do we need to improve in childcare, and how do we get there? Big question.
That is a big question, and that is so, you know, I have worn many hats, and so those many hats have allowed me to use multiple lenses to look at and understand the challenges that we are experiencing in especially early childhood education. And those are their immediate issues, you know, that have been brought on by COVID, but then there are issues that we know have existed for a really, really long time. Yeah. And I think whether you're looking at, you know, where early child education was before COVID, and then where we are now, what continues to still be the biggest issue is how early child education is understood and valued in our society. Follow the research, follow the science, whether it's, you know, economics, cognitive science, learning, human development, it all leads to one place. The early years are the most important years. Mm. And we know for a fact, I mean, and here's the part where, you know, the sense of urgency comes in. Children are children only once in their lives, right? That foundation is built now. I mean, when they're an infant, when they're a toddler, when they're in preschool, the foundation is critical. And, you know, you've heard me talk about the four pillars of development, right? That cognitive, that social, the emotional, that physical, that continues throughout life. And, you know, these four pillars, you know, just like a pillar holds a structure, you know, these pillars hold a child, hold a person throughout their lives. And if one of those pillars is weak, then that structure is weak, right? And we see, you know, if a pillar isn't repaired, you know, and someone goes through life, you know, off balance, I mean, eventually, you know, like a structure, they're going to collapse. And so we have to be looking, you know, more thoughtfully about those early years, you know, and the investments in those early years, and what are we investing in, you know, and yes, we want to have competent, confident educators in the classroom, but, you know, what are they teaching, and what are, you know, what is the why, right? And, you know, are they intentional? You know, it's, you know, again, taking that multifaceted approach instead of, you know, that process, you know, if we're going to solve the problem, we have to invest in the process. And we know that, you know, we need to, you know, look at early child education as and see more value in it. But what are the things that need to be in place to really make sure we're creating those learning environments that are really going to be impactful and giving children the foundation they need to be successful? And so, you know, it's going to take time, but as I say that, you know, we already know what to do. That's always been what's interesting in education and a lot of, you know, these problems that we're challenged with. Oftentimes we already know what we need to do. It's just the will, you know, to do it, and bringing people together And really, you know, allowing for those conversations to happen and really allowing for conversations, because there's a lot of, you know, discussion, but not really a conversation. And I, you know, go back to when you and I would talk and have these, we would just share, you know, our experiences and what our challenges were and, you know, how do we best support teachers and directors and children. And, you know, there was always sort of at the end of the day, at the end of the conversation, we kind of already, we knew what we needed to do next. And we did it. And fortunately it was on a small scale, but we saw the impact. And it was great work. And we saw, I like to think we made a difference.
So, you know, one of the things you said that we need to change the way that we see childcare, the way that we see early childhood and early childhood professionals. And I 100% like agree, believe that. And I think even if we know what to do, or some of us know what to do on, you know, what the way forward would be for progress and for growth, and to support children during their early years, even if we know that, or some of us know that, I'm agreeing with you, but like the conversation, I believe has to be had on a bigger, it has to be a larger conversation that we as the masses are talking about, not just the people that are in early childhood who are excited about it. We're already passionate about it. And, you know, we're like maybe elevating the profession amongst ourselves. But the only glimmer of hope I ever saw was beginning of pandemic, where it was like, oh, like we're valuing, you know, teachers. What kind of education journals, like teachers, and then we're valuing teachers and early child professionals kind of got lumped in there because, you know, we were needed, but it wasn't really the, I would say it was because they needed early childhood professionals to watch their children, they needed a place to put their children, not necessarily as I wanted a place or needed a place where they were going to be developed intentionally by this professional who's trained and, you know, all in these things, K-STEM and positive guidance and all that, whatever. The value of educators wasn't their actual professional expertise. It was that they were going to like have the children so that the parents could go to work. Now, that's a really important function that's necessary in society. I 100% agree with that and believe in that, but there is so much more value that the early childhood professionals and, you know, teachers and public school departments that they have more than just taking your kids for the 8-hour workday. And, you know, I said, you know, we were talking earlier, like we were exchanging text messages and, you know, we were talking about the video that I made that like the people have to change first before the system. Because even if we change a lot of the rules, I think other problems will, a lot of the same problems will persist, or similar problems will pop up, new similar problems will pop up, because we just don't value early childhood professionals.
I think part of that is, you know, going back to the why are they important? Why You know, does it matter? Yes, parents, you know, need childcare so they can go to work, but you know, that's a long period of time for children to be in a, you know, a space where, you know, they are, they're cared for, but there needs to be, you know, but so much more is happening, right? And so that why, you know, that when you have someone in a classroom, in an infant classroom or a toddler classroom or a preschool classroom that really does understand, and this goes back to our professional development and trainings, you know, understands ages and stages of development, you know, understands continuity of care, understands that, you know, there are all of these elements that, you know, make you a confident, competent, knowledgeable early childhood educator. You know, when parents are aware of that and see that and know this, it changes the way they view them. And you see this in very high quality programs where, yeah, you know, even infant teachers are seen as infant teachers. And the expectation is, you know, at each age and stage of development, they're building intentionally and deliberately on the next. What's happening in the infant classroom, that infant teacher understands how this age and stage of development is important, and builds on to the next age and stage, the toddler age and stage of development, and then the preschool age and stage of development. And it's very intentional, it's very deliberate. And when parents really see the difference and understand the difference, then it becomes impactful. It's just sometimes that's not always, those connections are not always being immediately, you know, realized, but when they are, that's when you have, you know, that cognitive shift. It's sort of like, yeah, that's what we want. That's what we want, and that's what we need, and we know we have. And, you know, that's why the work I'm doing now is so powerful to me, because it really does respect and acknowledge the continuum. So we do continuous improvement, just not in the K through 12 space, but from infants all the way through K through 12. And we do it in, you know, early learning, in STEM, in digital, in private, in public spaces. And that is really powerful to me, because, you know, there are so many environments in which children learn, and but they're all, you know, they all have different elements or they're all elements that are the same that make them a high quality program. I mean, they may do it in different ways, but there are many elements of the program that are very much the same, and we affectionately refer to them as best practice, right?
Yeah.
We know what is best practice, and they may look different, they may feel different, but you see in terms of those strategies and methodologies in the classroom, they are very consistent, and they all start with the teacher, right? Those teacher-child interactions, and so it's I think, you know, when we think of what early child education should be, and why it should be valued, and why there, you know, needs to be more focus and investment, you know, goes back to that why.
Yeah. But like, how do we get everyone else to be on board with the why, to know, to be invested in the why, at least? Mm-hmm.
Because it's our children, and gosh, I feel very cheesy and corny, but you know, I hear Whitney Houston's song coming, you know, I believe that's actually, it was, I remember Whitney Houston, but you know, I believe the children are our future, teach them well and let them lead the way. That's not a joke, right? And children only have, you know, one time in their life to be children, and we as a society, as a civilization, you know, need to take that to heart, because they are, and that should mean something, I hope.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm going to keep having these conversations. I know you will too. And hopefully this conversation that we've had it spreads to other people who continue the conversation with other people, who continue the conversation with other people, and maybe eventually that will be something that we as the mass of people value and are talking about, and then it becomes something people, you know, politicians are caring about too, and are valuing and prioritizing. Because it does, like you said, it does matter. This is their life, the most important, you know, formative years of their life. This is our world that they will inherit. And by the way, you know, at some point we're gonna be old farts who aren't going to be in control of anything, and they're going to be the ones in charge of our future, immediate or long term. So I don't know, maybe for some people thinking about their finiteness of their own lives will help them, mm-hmm. You know, maybe that'll inspire them. I don't know, but we'll keep on having conversations. We're going to close this one out. And Myra, are there any last words you'd like to say? You'd like to just speak to the world?
Wow, I was just enjoying speaking to you. It's hard for me to imagine speaking to the world, right? But I just know, I feel just so honored and humbled and privileged to just be able to participate in the conversation and to be, you know, at the table, engaging and bringing people along and seeing the world, you know, through, you know, one of my lenses, because I think we have so much potential. You know, every person is born with this incredible potential, and you know, if we get it right, Every human has the opportunity to realize the potential, and we only have to benefit from that, right?
Yeah.
And so I just feel so cheesy. You know, I started singing, you know, I Believe the Children Are the Future, and now I started singing, you know, John Lennon and Imagine, but you know, I think we don't need to be cynical when it comes to finding solutions and making an impact in the world. There is plenty of space for hope and belief. And I tell you, it's being an educator, being an early child education, you walk into the classroom and you are not thinking the worst. You are always thinking the best. Children have a way of doing that to you.
Awesome. One last thing I would like people to know before we close out, the book, I think, I don't know if she mentioned it, that it was actually a book, but Dr. Myra Sawyers has written a book, and she wrote it with Dr. Rosemary Burton, called STEM Early Learning.
The beginning of STEM Early Learning. And I just want to let people know it's a pocketbook. It was intentionally made to really be something very simple that you put in your pocket and, you know, just see how easy it is to teach and do STEM in the classroom. So it's not, you know, it's a very easy read, but hopefully it'll get you started right away.
What's my name? What's my name?
Bethlehem.
What's